The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking with secure cash management solutions for ultimate efficiency. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Lovely to have you with us. In a moment, we're going to be talking about ratings agencies. Yes, it's been a while since we did that. We'll talk to Noel Doyle, the Tiger Brands, with pressure under, with that company under pressure after years of issues. We'll talk to Fazam Essani with a huge surge in Bitcoin. We haven't spoken about Bitcoin for a while either. So there's lots to come on this evening's edition of The Money Show. Do stay tuned after Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock this evening. We'll also be bringing you some of the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been. Welcome to the Friday evening edition.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
So we are already in junk. So why should we worry, therefore, about the ratings agencies? Well, it's a bit like being in trouble at school. You get caught smoking, and the head teacher says, "Why have you been smoking?" And you say, "Well, I always like a cigarette with a drink." And the teacher explodes, but you reassure them that you never drive your car, which is hidden behind the bicycle sheds, while you're drunk. Imagine how much trouble you're in with the head teacher. Well, you can get yourself deeper and deeper into trouble, can't you, with the head teacher, just as you can with ratings agencies. Tonight, see separate pronouncements by two ratings agencies. The one that hates us least, that's Moody's, the one that warned more often than any other that we'd run out of money by now, and that was S&P Global. Well, earlier we got hold of Jeffrey Schultz, the senior economist at BNP Paribas, South Africa. He's not worried about Moody's.
A downgrade by Moody's looks unlikely this evening, given our view that the rating agency will probably await the outcome of the February 2021 national budget and current court ruling, that which is still pending, on the ability of the Treasury to enforce a real contraction in public sector wages this year before making any decision.
Well, we hope so. Thank you, Jeffrey. What about Kevin Lings, chief economist at Stan Lib? What's your expectation about tonight, Kevin Lings? It feels like forever since we've had to worry about a ratings agency, but it's here again.
Evening, Bruce. Yeah, we're worrying again, I guess. Look, there is a chance they downgrade us. Obviously, there's been significant deterioration in a whole range of parameters since Moody's last downgraded us, which was March of this year. And if you think how much has happened since March, it's fairly substantial. So, yeah, there's certainly scope for them to move us another notch down, which would take us two notches below. I guess what we hope is that they give us more time to get to the February budget and try and entrench some of the changes that the Minister of Finance highlighted in the medium-term budget. Moody's does have has had a tendency to give us kind of the benefit of the doubt. They certainly did that when we were investment grade, and the other rating agencies that took us below into speculative grade. So they've been more lenient with South Africa, if you like. So I guess based on that, you would expect that they continue to be somewhat more lenient, maybe give us some more time into next year. And then if we can start to implement particularly the wage agreement, that's going to be the critical factor, then perhaps we can hold on to this level, which is one notch below investment grade.
Why is it important not to slide further?
It's absolutely critical, because ultimately a country like South Africa, you would think, you would hope, would want to be investment grade. There must be an ambition, a goal. South Africa is a G20 country. It's a leading country within the African continent. It has to have ambitions of being an investment-grade credit rating. And there are huge advantages to being at that level in terms of not just the cost of debt, but the availability of finance opens up much more substantially. And given that South Africa has a very low savings level and therefore needs to constantly attract additional capital, it would help us enormously if we could get back to that investment grade. So the further you slip below investment grade, quite simply, the longer it takes you to get back. The average is generally around 8 years. Once you go below investment grade, on average, it takes countries 8 years to get back to investment grade. That's an awful long time. obviously you can shortcut that. If you South Korea, when they were downgraded, they got back there within 2 years. Other countries have taken significantly longer. And so if you go down another notch and then another notch, it all just makes it so much more difficult. And before you know it, you've spent a generation well below investment grade, and the cost of finance has been much higher than it ought to be. So it's a vital long-term objective, I would hope, for South Africa.
And the cost of finance is important because our tax collections have collapsed this year. We already had a budget deficit. We already were in trouble. But with hard lockdowns and the banning of selling of lots of different things and the economy shrinking probably 8% this year, it means tax collections are going to be negligible relative to previous years. So we have to borrow more. And the more we borrow at higher interest rates, the more we have to pay in interest each and every single day. And that's the worry.
That's exactly what ultimately does the damage. If you look at our interest cost, the minister told us in October that for the next 3 years, our interest cost alone is going to go up 16% a year. There's nothing that's going up 16%. It's the fastest growing element of the budget by far. And as a consequence, you can already see the compromise. The compromise this time has to be government salaries, but if you don't control the debt and you don't control the credit rating, then you've got to compromise somewhere else. You've got to cut back on healthcare, on education. All of these areas have to be cut back in order to pay the interest cost. Now, the minister's telling us, and I would agree, that by the time we get to February, the interest cost, just the interest cost, is going to consume 20% of total tax revenue. So before you do anything out of your tax base, you've got to allocate 20% just to the interest cost. And that's with a government debt level of just over 80%. The minister's saying that as it stands, our government debt is going to over 95%. So that under those circumstances, the interest cost is just going to ramp up. And if you continue on below investment grade, it ramps up even further until you get to the point where it just overwhelms you, where the interest cost is so big that you can't conduct your normal activity as a government. You just can't provide the services. And at that point, you are dysfunctional or more dysfunctional. So it's absolutely critical to control this, both in terms of the overall level of debt and in terms of the interest cost. If you look at countries like the United States, they have a government debt that is way bigger. It's over 100% of GDP, yet their interest cost is very manageable because the cost of the bond yield or the cost of the interest rate is less than 1%. And so if you can keep that low and you can keep your credit rating up, then you can afford if you need to take on a bit more debt. South Africa just can't afford to take on debt.
That is the problem. Thank you, Kevin Lings. Kevin Lings is chief economist at StanLib on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. South Africa goes to waiting mode again for the ratings agencies to make their pronouncements. And it's pitiful that we sit waiting for ratings agencies. But unfortunately, we've got ourselves into such an unholy mess over the last decade in terms of our huge dependency on borrowing and our inability to pay it back. And it wouldn't be so bad because we could make promises and say, look, guys, we're going to cut the public sector wage bill. Honestly, we are. But the trouble is we've made big, hairy, audacious promises in the past and we keep failing to deliver on them. So it's a credibility problem. Why should the ratings agencies take us more seriously? I hope they do. But there's a chance they won't.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
A disappointing year, says Tiger Brands. They've seen their profits down 23%. They're looking to cut costs by 500 million rand this year. They're cutting, or have cut, 400 jobs. Chief Executive Noel Doyle, we are seeing some food inflation coming back into the global grocery mix. We are seeing some money come back into the mix. There's some sort of increase in prices there. That's possibly good news for you, I would suggest.
Bruce, thank you. Look, I think the pricing really reflects the pressure on the input costs. The challenges on the demand side, you know, with 2 million people, additional people out of a job, remain in place. So we're expecting sort of pressure on margins going forward, and that's why we've had to focus very hard on looking for costs cost savings and efficiencies in our total supply chain to try and, you know, bring many of our premium brands sort of closer to an affordability level for the consumers.
How do you cut costs, and when you, especially when it comes to basic food production, you can, yeah, you still have to put the same amount of salt, the same amount of yeast, and the same amount of flour into a loaf of bread. Electricity prices keep going up and up and up. So where do you save costs?
What, one of the key things for us, Bruce, is to try and drive efficiencies out of our factories. The more efficient factories are, generally, the less wasted you have if you don't have, you know, stop-start breakdowns. So by focusing on the efficiencies, that's the first starting point. If you're running your factories more effectively, your utility costs come down, your what we call material usage variances come down, and you can meet demand without spending a fortune on overtime.
Yeah, which is hard, easier said than done, particularly in an environment where you have been told, listen, you're welcome to open your factories, but only one in three people can go to work, or however many it is, to ensure that there's social distancing in the workplace. We've seen how in meat packing plants in the United States, COVID has gone completely mad, and you've somehow got to be running your factories more cleverly, more efficiently, with fewer people. And it becomes, you know, again, a very demanding task.
Yes, Bruce, it has. And look, I'm happy to say that we've been able to adapt to the challenging environment and put the right protocols in place without it having a significant adverse effect on our efficiencies. You know, a lot of our factories are fairly mechanized to start with, and we've been able to run them pretty effectively with meeting all the social distancing requirements and all the other many sort of protocols that you need to put in place to keep your employees safe.
Do you see greater automation coming through as a result of the constraints that have been put on you in the last 8 months?
I don't think specifically linked to the constraints around COVID. You know, I think automation always becomes, you know, very much a sort of an economic decision based on the alternative in terms of increasing labor costs relative to the efficiencies of automation. I wouldn't say that we're making any decisions because of any constraints in terms of COVID-related protocols, Bruce.
Staple foods, the rices, the pastas, the stuff that we have at home when we are at home, did okay, because more in-home dining translates well, I think, to the basics that you produce. Treats and snacks, though, taking strain. Fewer office lunches, fewer lunch boxes getting packed, and that's one part of the business, of course, that is possibly more vulnerable to the vagaries of the economy than the stuff we actually need.
You're absolutely right, Reeves. You know, those areas took quite a hammering, particularly in the earlier stages of the harder lockdown. You know, the whole shopping occasions changed. People were going out less. The impulse purchase, the exercise and the gym utilization that drives the sales of Energade, really, those occasions were much lower. We've seen a nice recovery towards the end of the year. You do get a dynamic where people curb what we call discretionary spend. But what we're seeing a little bit, particularly in the chocolate side of the snacks and treats business, is that, you know, when people are looking for comfort or for a small indulgence in these challenging times, we've seen quite robust demand in that part of our business.
Thank you. Noel Doyle, the chief executive at Tiger Brands, a beacon of hope.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
How do you know that the Bitcoin price is likely to fall? How do you know? It's when I start talking about it, because we only ever really pay attention to the cryptocurrencies, either when they're fallen on their face, so we go, you see, we told you, or we start seeing that their prices are reaching elevated levels. And the Bitcoin rallying past $18,000 for the first time in 3 years yesterday, and I checked it a moment ago, it was really, really running hard at over $18,500. There's a huge amount of demand for cryptocurrencies. When you look at a graph, it did absolutely nothing for, like, you know, 10 years. Very little activity. And suddenly 2017 went to record levels around $20,000. And ever since then, the graph looks like a map of Mordor. If you've ever read Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, it's big and it's craggy and it's dark and it's scary and it's ominous. Fazam Hassani is the co-founder and chief executive at the cryptocurrency trading platform Valour.com. Are you excited, apprehensive, worried at the huge activity that you're seeing? You're what, 3 times higher than you were in April, from $6,000 to $18,000 a Bitcoin, Fazam?
That's right. I think everybody in the cryptocurrency world is excited. This is what the expectation and the thesis was. And as you rightly pointed out, things have changed a lot since 2017 till now. There was a big crash, as you said, and it's gained momentum. Just in the past year, since the beginning of the year, the Bitcoin price is up 169%. And in the last month, it's been up about 40%. So there's been a real big tick up over the last few weeks. And I think, Bruce, what's really notable about this run-up is that the retail market, for the most part, have pretty much been out of it. So I would call this new phase, we've moved from speculation in 2017 to allocation right now. And what I mean by that is that this run-up has really been driven by institutions and corporates. You may have seen that MicroStrategy, which is a NASDAQ-listed company, allocated about half a billion dollars to hold Bitcoin on balance sheet instead of the U.S. dollar. You see the likes of PayPal that have now offered the ability to buy and sell cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin to over 300 million of their customers. And just today, actually, BlackRock, the largest asset management firm in the world, one of their executives came on record to say that it's likely that Bitcoin may replace gold. So there's a lot of excitement in the world, but this is obviously against the backdrop of the traditional financial system and monetary system that has seen difficulties over the last few months.
But here's the point. I mean, I've seen it described as digital gold, as you mentioned, and you start seeing, lots of people putting money into what they believe is, every asset class in the world is volatile and scary right now. So let's diversify a bit and let's try a little bit of money in cryptocurrency. And that seems to be what is happening. Is it a good thing that in South Africa, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority is wanting to regulate crypto as a financial asset? It's a big endorsement, perhaps, of what crypto has done.
Yes, we've been engaging at Valour with the regulators for several years now. So they've put out a couple of position papers. What came out earlier today from the FSCA was a declaration, a draft declaration, that they're taking commentary from the market about making crypto assets a financial product. So we'll be engaging with them. It's interesting that a financial product, though, generally has a central issuer, a debt instrument or other things of that nature, whereas Bitcoin obviously doesn't have any issuer. So gold is not a financial product, according to the FASE Act. So we'll be engaging with them just to make sure that the interests of consumers are taken care of. But you're right, it is a very positive step forward. The regulators around the world, and particularly in South Africa, have seen the need to regulate the industry and to bring it under the umbrella of institutions that make sure that the malicious actors don't get to play in this space. And unfortunately, for some time, it has been known for that, but that's quickly changing.
How can you be certain that it's changing? How do you know who's malicious and who's not? Who's manipulating and who is actually buying for the long term? How can you tell in this faceless virtual world?
So it's a very good point. More and more people are learning about cryptocurrency and have more knowledge about cryptocurrency. And I think what we see is there are a lot of people that are susceptible to scams on things like Facebook. They see a tremendously attractive return, someone promising ridiculous percentage returns within a matter of days, and people fall for that. So what we say is, please talk to friends, talk to family, go onto the internet, do some independent research, because it's difficult sometimes to separate the good actors from the bad. But as we kind of develop and as we have more regulation, then those actors will find it much more difficult to play. So the regulators have been playing catch up until now, but the regulators now are very clued up and they are actually going after the malicious actors in the industry.
Okay, so a piece of good news on that particular front. I mean, dare you suggest that this goes higher than its previous high? Do you anticipate more volatility? Are we seeing some stability, dare we even suppose, in what's been a very, very, very ebullient market?
Well, let me put it this way. I think in 2017, we spoke, Bruce, and I think the price was about 60,000 Rand at the time. You had asked me if I thought it was going to go up, and I said certainly. And I got a bit of flack from friends and my workers for saying that. And it obviously has gone up. So rather than me giving a price prediction, let me just tell you that Citigroup, a bank, has given their price prediction of over $300,000 by the end of 2021. Now, that's probably a bit too high for my liking. I wouldn't say it's going to go that high, but I certainly think there's much more space to grow. As an entire asset class, cryptocurrencies are just valued over half a trillion U.S. dollars, and that compares to gold itself, just gold, which is valued at over $10 trillion. So cryptocurrencies are, in their entirety, are less than 5% of the value of gold, let alone other asset classes. So I think there's a lot of space to grow and for the price to rise, but volatility will remain. And I always say to everybody that's listening, beware, beware, because if you're expecting a direct line up, you will be sorely surprised. So this is a long-term thing, and the trend is upwards, but there will be a lot of volatility.
Fazam Esandi, thank you. A cool, calm head of cryptocurrency, co-founder and chief executive at Valor.com.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
David Peacock at Sunland Private Wealth. Have you ever filled your boots with cryptocurrencies? And I realize you can't actually fill your boots with cryptocurrencies because they are virtual currency. They don't exist in the real world as purely digital. But you understand what I mean, I think.
Exactly, Bruce. Well, Nouriel Roubini says that it's all rigged and it's totally manipulated, and anybody who gets sucked into it deserves what they get at the end of the day. And I think at the moment what you're seeing is as with the gold run that we saw a little bit earlier on in the year, you've seen a bit of FOMO where, you know, in the past, I think investors that have been looking for alternative investments to equity markets, bond markets, are possibly looking at this. And I think, you know, when asset classes and this is becoming a new asset class, when that starts happening, I think you just need to be a little bit cautious and, you know, as they like to say, dance close to the door.
just don't dance. Tell me about markets this week. It was a positive start after a positive end last week. And then from Wednesday, we've just seen this slow fizzle. And today, very much worried about what the ratings agencies are going to say later on this evening. SA Inc., the winner of the last month, some caution sort of didn't creep in, it jumped in.
Yeah, no, exactly, Bruce. You know, on the back of the news that these vaccines are coming through and the sort of solution to the pandemic in sight, you know, markets obviously reacting very positively to that. And then as time progressed and reality started to come back into the market, you know, you just saw a fair amount of sort of nervousness. And then obviously in terms of the South African market, the concern being that with S&P and Moody's re-looking at us again today and possibly only releasing their results later on tonight or during the weekend, you know, you saw that sort of concerns. And obviously, as Kevin Lings was saying earlier on in his interview, you know, there's not a lot of good news that is coming through subsequent to the medium-term budget and where we stand at the moment. So, you know, from that perspective, you saw, for example, the retailers and the banks retreating from that recent run that they've had. So, you know, volume's also fairly low on the day. So I think from that perspective, probably a bit of a wait-and-see situation at the moment.
The same for Tiger Tiger Burning Bright in the Forests of the Night. I don't know the rest of the poem, but Tiger Brands. It's just had a horrific half a decade, and it doesn't look like things are going to get too much better anytime soon.
Yeah, it has been a bit of a difficult time for them because ultimately when they were at the point of possibly pushing through some increases in terms of product, you know, we went into the peak of the COVID period. So, you know, clearly that would have stalled their profitability to a fair extent. You know, and I think going forward from here, what is going to be very important in terms of, you know, how the sort of food inflation starts trickling through in terms of their different divisions. I think, you know, one of the sort of small positives was the fact that, you know, they are in fact paying a divvy. And not sitting on a bad level of cash in the business. So possibly not as bad as expected, and ultimately the share was down about sort of just under just under 2%, sort of 1.75% on the day, Bruce.
David Peacock from Sanlam Private Wealth. Thank you very much indeed, David Peacock, one of our regular market commentators from Sanlam Private Wealth.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking with secure cash management solutions for ultimate efficiency. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. Let's talk about The Friday File. I've got a fabulous guest for you this evening on The Friday File. And it is called The Lollipop League. We'll do that in a few minutes' time before we play the Brutal Biz Quiz. And then between 7 and 8 this evening, some of the best bits from the week that has been. Coming up on the next Money Show, Pepe Marais, who's the Group Chief Executive Officer of Joe Public, taking us through his second and brand new book, 20 Habits That Break Habits, Growing Greatness and Other People's Money. Clunty Pye, the economist. I'm looking forward to talking to him about how he manages his money, results from Netcare and Pepco, and a whole bunch of other good stuff too, coming up on the next Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Bridget Barnett is the owner of Lollipop League. Now, I was very lucky recently to be playing a game of golf, Bridget, and nobody was allowed to serve any alcoholic drinks on the golf course. But they did offer me a suspicious array of lollipops. And they were yours. They were yours. There was gin and tonic. There was tequila. There was all kinds of things. Where did this idea come from?
You know, I think it came from the ether. I actually started the business not even making lollipops. And I called it the Lollipop League because it's from The Wizard of Oz. And I made a few lollipops because of the name. And then I just got inspired by the lollipops and just started making all sorts of crazy flavors.
What were you doing at the time that you were making lollipops? Well, you started making lollipops.
I had just finished a drama degree and had just come back from studying comedy improv in America. And so I was going around to auditions, and while I was going around to auditions, I was playing around in the kitchen.
And that playing around in the kitchen then results in a small business when you get back to South Africa. When does this all start? I mean, is this a real lockdown lollipop story?
Oh, no. I started in 2012.
Oh, my goodness me. You've been doing this for ages. Where have you been hiding?
Yes. Well, it takes a while, you know, to get everything perfect. And I've been building slowly at my own pace where it can be actually sustainable.
Is this the hustle? Is it a side hustle? Or is it when you're not performing, then you are boiling up concoctions on the stove?
No, this is all day, every day, especially this time of year. It's absolutely crazy pandemonium in the kitchen. It took over my life almost straight away because I do a lot of custom orders and corporate orders, and so I'm busy all the time.
Well, it's a lovely problem to have, Bridget. It is.
Yes,
it is.
Absolutely.
Where do you get the flavor? Where do you get the flavor inspirations from?
Just about everywhere. I'll taste something. Like one day I tasted a cookie and I absolutely loved the mix of flavors in the cookie, and I thought, let me try this in a lollipop. Otherwise, people come to me and ask me for flavor combinations, like my tequila, lemon and salt that you have. That was a request. And otherwise, I just think of flavors. When I come across a flavoring, I think of something that would go really nicely with it. And I try to make them, it's very important for me to have them as delicious as they are beautiful. And so I put all kinds of beautiful things in the lollipops, as well as having them taste amazing.
Now, I've seen, some of the lollipops have, you know, got little bits of plant life in them. There's some beautiful flowers. Yes. There's some pansies, for example, sort of boiled into the thing. And that stuff must be blooming nightmare to get right.
Sort of. You know, you play around and play around, and then you get things right. But the things in the lollipops, sometimes they're just decorative, but a lot of the times they're actually adding flavor as well as looking beautiful. Like the orange blossom and fennel florist, that the fennel actually adds a beautiful anise flavor into the lollipop that works really well with the orange blossom flavor.
A lot of people might be a bit freaked out by the alcohol element of this, tequila, lemon and salt, or gin and tonic lollipops. But I'm guessing that in the process, you're actually boiling off the alcohol. These are actually the flavors of the gins and the tequilas may be preserved within the lollipops, but there's no alcoholic content, is there?
Yes, you're absolutely right. But try have me explain that to like an 18-year-old. They just don't believe me. They're like, Maybe if I eat one more.
I don't know why you bother trying to explain that to teenagers. If teenagers want to suck the lollipops and makes them believe they're having a good time, then you should just let them have their way with your lollipops, Bridget.
Talk
to me about the market. Is this really made to order? Because I don't think I've not seen you on shelves in shops. I mean, this really does seem to be made to order stuff.
Yes, a lot of it is made to order. I'm in a few little boutique shops, and what I generally do is I do like festivals. For example, Karma's Festival, I have a little lollipop pop-up bar that goes on there. That's happening in 2 weeks. And then I have a huge array of flavors. But otherwise, in little shops, I have a smaller selection of flavors.
And how much training did you have? I mean, mucking about in a kitchen is one thing, but did you get any sort of formal training in terms of actual food production and that sort of thing?
Well, I'll tell you what, I had absolutely no training. I just started playing around. But it turns out, once I started playing around, my mother grew up on a farm, and so in America, and so on the farm, they would make their own candy all the time. So she had never told me that she used to do this. But once I started playing around, she would come to the kitchen and be like, "Nah, you're doing that wrong. Oh, you should add this." And so she ended up teaching me a whole lot, but it was very much trial and error.
And as you look at this, I mean, does it stay a small enterprise forever? Have you been approached by larger players who said, "Yeah, well, we quite like this idea. Could we have some recipes, please, and buy the business?"
Well, I like it as being an artisan business and me being the artisan, but it has room for a lot of growth now because, as people want more lollipops, I just start expanding and expanding.
But you're still doing this in your home kitchen?
Yes.
And at what point do you break out? Are you close to that sort of point?
Well, yes. Actually, this year was supposed to be, before COVID, was supposed to be moving into a new kitchen, hiring more staff. But, of course, things happen. I don't actually want anyone else in my kitchen at the moment. But next year, I'm hoping for expanding to a new kitchen, more staff, and expanding production.
Look, it's a very exciting story, and well done to you for doing it, for biting the bullet or biting the lollipop, as you choose to express it. Lovely to hear stories of inspirational small businesses. Have you got a Christmas flavour this year? Is there a sort of a Christmas pudding with brandy lollipop?
It sounds horrendous. You have to try the gingerbread.
Gingerbread lollipop?
It's gingerbread, and then it's got shimmer in it, so it's really in the Christmas spirit.
Excellent. Good. As long as you're taking advantage of the season. Bridget Barnett is the owner of the Lollipop League. Been around since 2012. I came across them the first time a couple of weekends ago. And it's fabulous. It's a lovely idea. And it's a weird sensation. Psychosomatic is the word. You have one of these things, you think to yourself, shouldn't have more than one, you know. It's only 10 o'clock in the morning. But hey, it's all the booze is burnt off. And you just get some lovely flavors coming through.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Time to play the Brutal Biz Quiz on a Friday night. So that means that you need to pick up your cellular telephonic device, or if you still have a landline, you can pick that one up and you can dial 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. You will give us a call and play the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening, because that we would like you to do that. And then you can have the whole weekend to brag about what a genius you are and how you whipped everybody else's butt. That is what we need. We need your ego stroking tonight. That's what we want to do. I would like to know, which UK airline wants to scrap quarantine policies? Airlines are finding themselves all tied up in knots at the moment because they are responsible for ensuring that you are COVID clear when you get on the plane, and then they've got to test you, check you, and really jump through lots of hoops. And one of them is saying, no, this far and no further. What is the name of the airline? It's a British airline. It's a UK airline that is looking to change the way in which quarantines work. 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Do give us a call and let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, with secure cash management solutions for ultimate efficiency. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Brutal Biz Quiz time. Let's play the Biz Quiz. You give us a call on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. Through first this evening in Lone Hill is Gladwin. Good name if you're going to play a competition, Gladwin. You feel very confident, clearly. Let's play this game this evening. The airline that wants to scrap quarantine policies is which airline, Gladwin?
British Airways.
British Airways is absolutely right. Announcing it'll test passengers for COVID-19 in a bid to prove that the UK's quarantine policy should be scrapped. Currently, due to the coronavirus pandemic, some international travellers arriving in that country must self-isolate for 14 days. Which US country singer is credited for playing an important role in the COVID battle?
US country singer.
Yeah, she's very much before your time, I think. She and Kenny Rogers, Islands in the Stream. Her name?
Dolly Parton.
Oh!
Is it Dolly Parton?
Just in time. Just in time, Gladwin. It is Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton. She was the singer of 9 to 5. She was the singer of Jolene. She donated $1 million to fund research for a coronavirus vaccine. Anyway, let's not get there. After a promising announcement from on Monday, fans are crediting her with saving the world. Anyway, she's lovely. I'd like the name of the third richest person in the world. He went to Pretoria Boys High. What is his name?
Is it Elon Musk?
Elon Musk, Gladwin, doing nicely. Elon Musk's personal wealth grew by $15 billion after Tesla found itself a top spot in the S&P 500 index on Monday, and he is on track to become the world's third richest individual, overtaking Mark Zuckerberg. And yeah, he's had an extraordinary wealth-creating year. Now, there was a World War II battle. It was a tactical battle. It was a very difficult battle. And former President Jacob Zuma is said to be using similar tactics in his legal defenses. What was the name of the battle, Gladwin?
Recusal.
Recusal is not the name of a battle, I'm afraid. Recusal is what he was trying to get Justice Zondo to do, and throwing all kinds of obstacles in his way. So, Gladwin, you're a superstar, but not the Wizard of the Biz Quiz this evening. George and Germiston, the name of the battle.
Can I just give Normandy?
Normandy? No, it's not Normandy. I've not ever heard of anybody refer to, because Normandy was pretty, you know, pretty done and dusted. There were defenders, there were attackers, and it happened really quickly. Vroom, and went through, and that was the end of the battles of Normandy. No, it was a different kind of battle, George. Abdullah in Pretoria.
Yeah, it was a battle of Stalingrad.
Absolutely. Stalingrad was the battle. This week it turned into the old strategy. And then he turned another strategy, and it was more of an Italian strategy. It was the strategy of running away. The strategy of wearing down the plaintiff is you fight anything that is thrown at you, and you appeal everything, and you fight, and you tact, and you strategize. And it's named after the Russian city of Stalingrad, besieged by the Germans in World War II. And the most famous use of the Stalingrad strategy has been by the former president, Jacob Zuma. Kemp J. Kemp once said, this is not a battle where you send a champion out to have a little fight and that's it. This is more where we fight them in every room, in every street, in every house. Now, Abdullah, what is the prime lending rate at the moment? Exactly, please.
It was unchanged on Thursday.
No, I know it was unchanged, but that isn't the what question. I would like to know a number. What is the prime lending rate?
I think it's 3.5.
3.5 is the repo rate, Abdullah. Oh. William in Brakpan, what is the prime lending rate?
7%.
7%, absolutely right, William. The lowest it's been in 50 years. Reserve Bank Governor Lisa Tichaniaho didn't mess around this week when he decided to leave rates unchanged. The craft beer Soweto Gold is owned by which Dutch beer company?
Heineken.
Heineken, absolutely. Do you know any other Dutch beer companies? I suppose there's Oranjeboom and a couple of others, but I wouldn't have known off the top of my head any other Dutch beer makers. Soweto Gold and the Soweto Brewing Company were bought by Heineken. We spoke to the managing director of Heineken South Africa, Gerard van Loo, this week about further investment in South Africa. And they said, no, the plans for KZN and for expanding a brewery there are very much still on ice. William, that makes you the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening. You can get a t-shirt printed if you want to, at your own expense, unfortunately. And you can wear it, and you wear it with pride. And it can say anything like, I am the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz. And then you take a photograph and post it on social media and tag me. Tag me, William. And I will say, look at this. This is the whiz of the Biz Quiz wearing a t-shirt saying, I am the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz. Thank you for playing, William. Thank you for everybody for playing. Glad when you started so well. But unfortunately, the Brutal Biz Quiz is precisely what it is. Brutal. After Eyewitness News, we are going to bring you the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been. Please do stay tuned for that and all of our weekend programming.